From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. If you want to hire a diverse workforce, what are the questions you need to ask?
You know, what courses do people take? What life experiences do they have, right? What ways of thinking do they kind of apply to problems?
That's University of Michigan diversity expert Scott Page. In his latest book, The Diversity Bonus, he shares evidence that teams made up of different kinds of thinkers outperform homogeneous groups on complex tasks. He calls this the Diversity Bonus. Today, we hear more from Scott and a panel of experts on why diversity in the workplace matters and what it means. But first, we spoke a while back with T-Boz. She's the lead singer of TLC. TLC, one of the most famous pop groups of all time, but particularly the 1990s, and it all started right here in Atlanta.
That's where I learned a lot of flavor that I did in TLC when I choreographed some of our dances. I just love their swag and the whole vibe there. So I'm so happy I grew up there.
Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is Regina McDuffie. I'm calling from Lazella, Georgia. I think my favorite song, of course, is Waterfalls. It has such a lasting, such a powerful message. But you can't help but love No Scrubs because it just is so unique and funny. But the best thing about TLC is that they're a lasting group.
This is Ryan Lewis calling from Athens, Georgia, from KinderCore Vinyl. We've got three vinyl presses here at KinderCore, and we've named each of them after the members of TLC. So T-Boz is a 7-inch press in Athens, Georgia.
Roy Lee tweets, "My favorite TLC song is No Scrubs, because as a non-scrub male, it's funny when scrub dudes get called out." Well, we always want to know what you think, listeners. Regardless of your scrub or non-scrub status, call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Hiring people of different races, genders, and socioeconomic statuses has to be more than just integrating an office. Last week, my colleague Celeste Headlee moderated a panel discussion at Atlanta's Carter Center on this issue. This conversation about workplace diversity was part of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation's Our Compelling Interests series. The panel, recorded before a live audience, included four distinguished guests. In this first section, we meet Andrew Davis, Global Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer with the Coca-Cola Company. Scott Page is a diversity expert at the University of Michigan. And we hear first from panel member Gail Evans, former CNN Executive Vice President.
One of the problems, I think, with the whole diverse discussion around diversity is it's sort of the zero-sum game. You know, you misstep in some kind of way, and there's no way to come back from it.
Are you talking about, say, a white person asking to touch an African-American's hair and they're racist? This is an honest question. This happens
right. It's true.
All the time.
Or J.J. Reddick.
That's where we are.
Right. Yeah.
It's so,
yeah,
we're so sensitive now.
Right. That's right.
Everything.
And
nobody
so
touches
one of the things we have to really foster and push and enforce, I see it in the course I teach at Georgia Tech. We are forced to talk about gender, and we are forced to talk about race. And I sit up there and try to create an atmosphere for the students where somebody can say something
wrong.
Then something wrong, something that somebody else may not think was the perfect thing. And when everybody, that's hard in the workplace.
It is.
But still in the workplace, it is possible that getting to, once you are in a group and you get to know each other, some of this begins to fade away because you become people.
Next to me is Scott Page. So identity diversity is quite easy to identify, right? By definition, I can often see and very quickly see who has identity diversity. How do we know who has cognitive diversity?
What you want to look at is you want to ask, you know, what courses do people take? What life experiences do they have, right? What ways of thinking do they kind of apply to problem? How do you look for cognitive diversity? One way you do that is you have diverse people look at people. So one thing that Google did, and this is sort of fascinating, they get 3.5 million applicants. So imagine if anybody were in missions or something. That's a huge number. And if they just randomly pick someone, then that person has obviously a 50% chance of being better than an average Apple
employee.
So the first interview gets them to like 70%. The second, if they have a second person interview, it gets them to like 76%. A third person gets them to 82%. A fourth person gets them to 85%. But then after that, they don't get much of a advantage. Well, you see that, but that difference from 72 to 86, that's enormous. I mean, that's a huge increase. And where is that coming from? That's coming from different sets of people looking at candidates, you know, through different lenses, because they're having diverse people interview, to get this bonus, to make much better hiring decisions.
Does cognitive diversity end up meaning that a company can hire an entire slew of white males, no offense, because they come from odd, you know, diverse enough backgrounds that they can say we have cognitive diversity?
So you will. I mean, I think it's a fascinating question, right? So the reality is, I can take a group of white men that are not cognitively diverse at all, right? They could have, you know, if you look at, you know, the elite, like the Ivy League schools in the 1960s, right. It was wealthy families. The kids went to Exeter, right? They go to Princeton, and they all look the same, right? I could also take a group of white men that are more diverse, right? But the reality is, if I want to have full diversity, right? If I really want to have, you know, the full sort of, you know, array of ways of looking at a problem, if I choose from any one, you know, gender grouping, you know, ethnic grouping, I'm not going to get as much diversity as if I have gender diversity and identity diversity. It's just not going to, it's not going to happen. So yes, I mean, I think the interesting thing is that is, in a lot of these organizations, they're aware that you need people who think about problems in different ways, right? And the question is to get them to recognize that people who look different from them also think about things in different ways.
So, Andrew, how does it, another change that Scott suggests in the book is to stop talking about diversity in sort of moral terms, that this is the right thing to do, and instead to talk about it in terms of that this is just the best business plan. Mm-hmm. How different, how big a change is that for a company as large as Coke?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. We still say and. We believe that it's morally the right thing to do, and I think you say that.
Yeah.
But it's also a business imperative because we try to make sure that we bring to the table, you know, what's the business case and what's the proof points for having a more diverse workforce. Now, you know, Gail, you're right. There are so many books or so many research that actually talk about the business case for diversity, and you can actually have a book on that right now. But what's happening a lot is that it's getting a bit stale. And it gets stuck in the middle management side of the house. So what we're trying to do here a little bit differently is try to bring, you know, those proof points of why diversity can actually make a difference in your workforce and your performance more relative to us. So we try to pull out business cases and say, hey, here's where it's happening. One quick one I'll share with you that's in production right now. We have what we call business resource groups in our company. And we have the Hispanic Leadership Business Resource Groups. And we were looking at trying to find a way how they can actually drive value within the company more than they do in terms of what resources groups traditionally do, which is kind of flag, food, and fun. And we wanted to get away from that and really focus on the business side of things to help show the value of why diversity matters. So they went out and actually went and solved the problem. We were actually working with our marketing teams, and they were trying to find a better way to interpret what we call our POS signage, things that you might see as we post our products in stores or on menus or what have you. And we wanted to find a way to interpret those POS signage in the respective markets that we serve, Latin markets mainly, and make
POS,
sure it's
relevant.
I don't
want to leave people behind with all the acronyms. Point of sale.
I'm sorry. So point of sale is just wherever you go when you see a product that you can buy, and it tells
a
you something about the product.
Vending machine or, wherever you're going to buy.
Menus, what have you, right?
Coca-Cola.
So you're right. Keep me honest. So we actually hire a marketing firm that helps us translate those signage, translations of them, right? And it costs us about $500 per translation.
Literally translating them.
Literally.
In Arabic or whatever.
Whatever it might be. Now, in some cases, we found that some of those translations can be even offensive words or words that don't have no context in what we're trying to say.
Right.
Our business resource group.
Don't repeat any of them.
I will not. Our business resource group actually now are the ones that are helping us translate those signage in respective markets where we have a bit of a nuance with the context of a word, a phrase, or what have you. And we are basically now using those things, examples like that, to bring the business case to life. So for us, it's an and. It's the right thing to do because of the markets that we operate in. You better do right by the communities you serve in. And two, there is a business imperative for diversity, and we're bringing it to life by some examples like that within our company.
But isn't that identity diversity? Then that's where I get confused in the discussion. That I understand our brains. I mean, I want a diverse team intellectually.
Yeah.
But I was trying to think of examples business-wise, and I can think of 100 of them about whether it's the Frito-Lay chips that the Latino group came up with, or whether CNN in the beginning, we began CNN Hindu. We didn't have a diverse team, and somebody put some cows in the opening montage, and we lost 2 days of business while everything had to be redone and the rest. I mean, we can go over all these. These all seem to be cases about proving the economic case for identity diversity. I know how important the cognitive part is, but it's like we all slip back to the part we can't do, which is identity diversity. Right, we can't do very well.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to say in the book, what I'm trying to work through logically, is when you, even in those cases where you say it's identity diversity, so let me talk about like the beer industry instead of the soda industry. So they have their thing is MOT, which is moment of truth.
Right.
You know, you walk into the bar and you stand there and you see all those paddles they could pull, and there's this moment of truth, and you say Stella Artois, whatever you say. And and if I'm trying to understand, so Leo had been the CEO of Miller, which doesn't sell Stella Artois. When they would have their big annual board meeting, he would have everybody go out and just watch people drink beer in Chicago, right? And watch the moment of truth. And part of the reason for doing this is it's a real diversity lesson, because if you're looking at people who aren't from your identity group drink beer, you can't understand their moment of truth. And so when you think about it, you're saying that's identity, and it is identity, but it's your identity informing how you see the world, right? So the thing is at the end of the day, your identity has to translate into framing. So one thing that psychologists talk a lot about is how we place things in categories. And if I know nothing about a community of people, my categories are very, very crude categories. If I know a lot about a group of people, my categories are much finer, and I have deeper understandings of those groups. And so it's I was recently at a thing with a women certified financial analyst, and I was talking to someone, and she was saying that, you know, she got put on this team to, at first she thought it was very gendered, to analyze the cosmetics industry, and she was kind of upset about it. Then she got in there, and it was 55-year-old white guys like me, even though I'm looking pretty good in my makeup right now, but for the most of the time, I'm not rocking any makeup. And there's probably not, I probably can't add anywhere near as much to that conversation as a 30-year-old woman could add to that conversation. So, but it's her identity that's giving her these filters, these mental models, these life experiences, these understandings of the products that really are cognitive differences, right? So I think when you're saying identity, I'm saying that identity is actually playing out. No one's applying their identity to the problem. Their identity affects how they see the world and how they think
about
the
world. Their identity changes their cognition.
Right.
We heard there from University of Michigan diversity expert Scott Page, Coca-Cola's Andrew Davis, Global Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer. Also, former CNN Executive Vice President Gail Evans speaking with On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee at the Carter Center in Atlanta. More of that conversation is just ahead. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. We're talking this hour about diversity in the workplace. Last week, my colleague Celeste hosted a panel discussion on the issue at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Before the break, we heard three members of that panel: former CNN Executive Vice President Gail Evans, Andrew Davis of the Coca-Cola Company, and University of Michigan diversity expert Scott Page. Now they're joined by Janine Cabrera-Veldi, a training and communication specialist at Emory University. Celeste asked her about pushing the diversity envelope on a college campus.
One thing that her research has proven over and over and over again is that even though diversity is really good for us, especially when it comes to problem solving, it's not comfortable.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So your whole specialty is training. How do you prepare people for the discomfort that comes from having to deal with a diversity of opinions and views?
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes with a lot of team building in particular, because I feel like if you're really good at that within each team, I think that you can get to, like, learn one another and really get to expand on these types of diversity that you're trying to bring out. So that might mean, like, only a few days ago, we did something like the MBTI, where we had a group do that to really learn about the Myers-Briggs type indicators that really tell you, like, what different personality types you have. And really trying to find, well, what are the commonalities within a group and how are we different, right? So that we know how to talk to each other, so we know how to understand each other. So I think it comes from that perspective, too, that you need to really bring in is preparing people. Or also building off what Andrew was saying, I think it's really important for people to understand that you need to see how things are operating outside of your organization, too. So one thing I really do at Emory and I try to emphasize is we do something called leadership labs where we have case studies that they study to see what's going on at other organizations that are doing diversity really well and where it's really failed. And so when you kind of see how big names have really failed in these areas, I think it motivates people to say, hey, maybe diversity is important, and maybe it's not something that I need to always just shun away or try to escape from. But you have them develop themselves why diversity is important without you having to state the case yourself.
Well, since you brought up failure, let's talk about some of the failures. Google is a really good example. When the engineer's memo went global, complaining about diversity programs, not Coca-Cola, but Pepsi had its own failure when they released the Jenner video where she was solving the racial problems of America by offering a Pepsi. So let's talk about failures, and I want to hear from each of you about maybe a failure that's occurred in your institution and how you recovered from it. Gail, do you want to start here? Was there a diversity failure?
Well, I think you see in the news business for decades.
Mostly white and male.
Yeah, right. It was white and male, and what it was about in a lot of places was white males deciding what older females wanted to watch. Because that was so much of the audience.
Yeah.
But I saw the major places where I saw in the news business the diversity failures were that if you didn't have a diverse team, identity-wise and cognitively, but certainly identity-wise, you just made mistakes. You used words that were wrong. You did something silly like...
You called people leaders.
Right. I mean, all of the things that if you don't have somebody who can represent the views of different groups. When you're in the discussion, what you're going to do is make mistakes, and some of them you can't recover from. I'm more interested... The news business, I think it's very obvious, because whenever there's one of those things, it pops up. But I think we look at it with companies like Walmart in Germany, which did not understand the culture and failed. Home Depot, you know, which failed in China. Those are all examples of the team didn't understand where they were going. And the lack of diversity, that the same think was what got them in trouble. And so I have great worries about diversity because I believe that most of us in any kind of leadership understand its importance. Getting from the intellectual understanding to the action is a place where we have been stuck for generations.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And we don't, and it's really at best creeping incrementalism, the changes that we make.
Oh, that's really true. Andrew, can you think of a diversity failure?
Yeah, I think you know, it wouldn't be an honest to say that we haven't had plenty of those. It's just the nature of being human and the business that we're in, being in so many markets. But one that comes to mind, you know, we were actually trying to land an account. As an account here actually locally with our Korean Grocers Association. And we were struggling to connect with that consumer. And I think it just came down to cultural differences that we didn't understand. And they were just not open to doing business with us based on small nuances that I won't necessarily get into, but I will tell you that it was a cultural fail and it was a diversity fail. It wasn't until we had one of our associates of this BRG, again, Business Resource Group, that actually went in, who was Korean descent, told us that here's the missing link. It's just a matter of how you show respect and how you actually talk to these leaders. And arrogance that you may have as you come into, we're Coke, you got to sell this brand, you know, walk away. And believe it or not, companies can be arrogant, and we've had some failures in that, right?
Shocking.
We're trying to be much more humble, and I think this was a humble lesson learned to say, hey, look, just because you believe you're the biggest and the baddest in the business, it doesn't mean that you can't have humility, and you can't have a way to show respect when you're trying to, you know, bring a customer into your family. And so this one person who was tied into and was a relative of one of the leaders there helped us to understand that here's how you speak to our customers, here are you respect them, and here's what's important to them when they have our products on our shelves. And that changed the game. But I think the thing that I think about is that, you know, making sure that you not only have the right people in the room when these issues are occurring, but having the courage, the culture to let people speak up. Because
and
I think that's
them.
What, and empower them to say, this might be unpopular, but it's the right thing to do. If you want to help your company, make sure your company don't have these mistakes or fail really publicly like some of these companies have, it's not only about having representation or cognitive diversity, but courage, which is really about culture. Do I allow, am I allowing people to speak their minds, even if it's unpopular? That's what we're trying to crack the code on at Coca-Cola.
And that is tough.
Okay.
And we're going to get to that in just, that's our very next thing. But first, Janine, can you think of a diversity failure?
Yeah. Well, for me, ever since I got to Emory, I was trying to think of new ways that we can get diversity. And so I was like, you know, we got to do really diverse interview panels. And so we did that, and we were involved in that in the hiring process. And so when the candidate leaves, we have all these diverse people from different departments, like gender diversity, all different types of people in the room, and they couldn't agree on what candidate to pick. And they were like, Janine, you know, you suck because we're spending like 8 hours having to decide on which candidate we like because everyone has a different perspective, a different framework, and they're like, you're wasting our time, Janine. Like, we spent so much time in disagreement that is this really even worth it?
Wow.
So I spent a lot of time thinking to myself, well, what was the missing link? Like, why did they have all these conversations that lasted so long where they couldn't come up with consensus? And I went back to the drawing board, and I was like, hey, I think what the missing link here is really to think about how can we make our interview process more objective? So then I got everyone trained on something called, I don't know if you know, it's the STAR interview method. So it's kind of behavioral interview methods. And so I got everyone trained so they would know exactly how to ask the question, how they'd rate their answer, and so that everyone would know what they'd look for in a person's response. And so after that, all those hours that would take in deliberation kind of went away because people knew how to be more objective with the answers they were getting from particular candidates. So that eliminated also a lot of biases that you have, too, when you're looking at a particular candidate because you have to stick to what did they actually say, like when they're actually responding to each and every question. So that's kind of how we worked through it. It was hard to kind of make the case that, hey, no, we still need to keep diverse panels, but we need to put everyone on the same page.
So, Scott, do those those behavioral tests, do they work better than your standard job interview at looking for cognitive diversity?
So it was just the the director of the National Intelligence just had a big meeting where we were talking about, like, how do you find cognitive diversity? And it's interesting because they had all these people who, you know, study what you study. And it's fascinating because it really depends on the nature of the task. Right, so for psychological operations, they would say yes, right? But for other tasks, they would say no. You're actually better off giving people a technical problem and seeing how they solve it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of this stuff is conditional. I mean, like this point about, like, does identity diversity give you value? I mean, the thing is that the diversity bonus couldn't have been written in 1920 because most jobs were kind of physical jobs, and there really weren't diversity bonuses.
Yeah, they're factory jobs.
I mean, it's like, you know, so I talk about, like, if you're hiring people to cut down trees, look, line the people up so you can cut down the most trees and hire those people. But don't discriminate, right?
Yeah.
But now we're in these really high-dimensional, complex problems, and hiring the best is even if you could give some sort of test, there's no test you could give where the best team would consist of the best people on that test because the test is a one-dimensional measure, and you're looking for an ensemble of people with different skills. Where I see the big failure, and pulling back to your question, is I've been to any number of companies, and I'll be sitting down with, like, the CEO and, like, the leadership. And the person will say, we're a meritocracy. And I'll say, I'm looking at 12 white guys.
Yeah.
you've got like 100,000 employees in 20 countries, and like the best 12 are all white guys?
You're listening to a panel discussion on diversity in the workplace recorded last week at the Carter Center in Atlanta. On Second Thought, host Celeste Headley moderated, and you just heard University of Michigan diversity expert Scott Page. Also contributing, Emory University's Janine Cabrera-Veldy, former CNN Executive Vice President Gail Evans, and Andrew Davis of the Coca-Cola Company. Here again, Celeste Headley.
This is what comes to my mind, Gail, and I'm going to start at that end again, but it's a question for all of you, so you have more time to think. So I worked on a show called The Takeaway in New York. The whole purpose of that show was to appeal to non-whites, which is a problem that public radio has. And we had a very diverse staff. But oddly enough, all of our management was white. And therefore, we ended up covering the exact same stories that the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal covered. Because when you got everyone at the table for a pitch meeting and someone would say, hey, let's cover this blah, blah, blah festival in whatever barrio, they would say, no, that's not actual, that's not a news story. And they'd move on, right? Everyone who was in management had the same set of standards by which they judged what was most important and what was not. So that meant it didn't matter how diverse the staff was, the end product ended up sounding exactly like the all-white male news down the street. How do we balance the experience of management, which I know in news, but in most places, is white and male, no offense, with the need to empower and hear from these voices in order to actually take advantage of diverse thoughts?
So I think, number one, we have to acknowledge that this is about the shifting of power. But I think that's something we never own up to. That we pretend, okay, this is kumbaya, and it's going to be wonderful for everybody, and that just because, and if you add some more diversity, you're not going to take away from the group which is now, running things. So I think that we don't have honest conversations about it. But I'm going to do a plug. I can do one for Coca-Cola and one for Georgia Public Broadcasting, because it's very interesting. We have a new program on Georgia Broadcasting. About a year old, called The Seat at the Table. And it is three African-American women of different backgrounds, different generations, different views of the world. A producer who came up through the ranks, who began actually as a makeup person at Georgia Public Broadcasting, who is also African-American. And a boss in Taya Ryan, who runs Georgia Public Broadcasting, who said, we need to hear these voices, and I want to listen to what you want to talk about, but I want to learn from you. And you do what you think we need to hear. And everybody I know who's listened to the program walks away, especially if you're white, going, wow, I learned something today. I didn't know that. And these three women don't necessarily agree with each other. That's part of what's wonderful about it. And we get exposed to it. It is possible for the power structure to actually let go and give it those kind of things to talented people to run. And my plug for Coca-Cola is that. it's important for people to understand that I think for politicians and for news people, when you travel the world, if you want to check in and find out what's happening in a country and you don't know it very well, you don't go to the U.S. Embassy. You find the Coke office. Because Coca-Cola, through history, has ensured that there is cultural diversity out there and that their people on the ground understand where they are. This is not impossible to do if we confront it straight on. But I think we dance about it. We talk about it's the right thing to do. That's not how power shifts, and that's not how organizations operate. This is about getting it done because it is an imperative.
You know, with our scope as far as being in 207 countries and that responsibility, we have an advantage because we have basically United Nations, even right here in Atlanta, in the home office. We have almost 90 different nationalities that are part of the Atlanta complex. We have our global headquarters right down the street here.
Are they also represented in the executive management?
I would say yes. There is absolutely great diversity and nationality there. Where I'm going with my point about this is that it's not the case for every company who has that natural pick of talent for the most part. And by the way, it wasn't for us either many years ago when you think about what our leadership team was made up of. So I think it starts first with a declaration. You've got to declare that this is important. It has to start from the very, very top. The CEO and the board must say diversity matters. We believe that the power of innovation is a key to growth, and underneath that is diversity.
That's Andrew Davis of the Coca-Cola Company speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. This panel discussion is about diversity in the workplace. We also heard from Scott Page with the University of Michigan, Janine Cabrera-Veldy of Emory University, and former CNN Executive Vice President Gail Evans. Just ahead, the conversation's conclusion. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Tomorrow we take a trip to Sesame Street.
Sunny day sweeping the clouds away. On my way to where the air is sweet.
Where the air is sweet.
Celeste Headley talks with Fran Brill of Savannah. She was the first female Muppeteer hired by Jim Henson for Sesame Street. You may know her best for her role as the lovable character Zoe.
My name is Zoe, and I'm proud, I'm proud, I'm proud. And what I'm proud about, I'm gonna tell you right out loud. I can spell my name.
Fran visits Atlanta later this week for an event at the Center for Puppetry Arts to honor the women of the Muppets. We'd love to hear from you. Who is your favorite Sesame Street character? Maybe it's Maria, whom we'll also hear from later this week. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can reach out to us on Twitter. Our handle is at OST Talk. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. We're talking this hour about diversity in the workplace. Last week, my colleague Celeste Headley hosted a panel discussion on this issue at the Carter Center in Atlanta. The panelists include Scott Page of the University of Michigan, Janine Cabrera-Veldy of Emory University, Andrew Davis of the Coca-Cola Company, and former CNN Executive Vice President Gail Evans. Here's Celeste.
Janine, how do you create a culture in which people value opinions that sound wrong? I mean, let's be honest. When a certain culture has been the right answer for decade after decade after decade, then when someone else has a different answer, it sounds wrong.
Yeah, so I think it comes down to kind of creating the platforms for people to really express themselves. Because I think that there is kind of this fear that people have when they know they're not of the dominant culture and they might have a differing opinion. So kind of to try to bring it concrete, what we do at Emory, because we had this issue, was we actually researched a lot of, like, well, what if we did, like, an audience response system? And we use Mentimeter, where people, like, if you're in a meeting and you need to propose a solution or say how you feel about how something's been going, people can anonymously, right through their cell phone, respond to certain questions that a manager or a leader is proposing so that they don't feel necessarily targeted for their opinion or what they really think. And then how it's
treated is anonymous, right? So they don't know if it's coming for a guy or a woman.
Right.
Right.
And so we saw a lot of great results by using that particular system. And we got a lot more opinions. People were starting to get praised for things that they would share. And solutions that the people themselves were coming up with were being valued and being actually used and implemented because the person up front didn't know who it was coming from. Right, so you don't have the opportunity to say, well, that person's different from me, and they're obviously wrong, and thinking about all the biases that you come with when you might declare someone wrong, too. So I think that you have to give people the platforms to be able to express themselves and not assume that just because someone's not sharing something doesn't mean that they don't have a voice and they have an opinion. I think too many times we assume that people are voiceless and that we know what's best for them. But they have a voice, and you have to give them the platforms to be able to express themselves.
Gail, what we're really talking about here now is not just diversity but inclusion, right?
Yeah.
And that's, there's a difference. You can have as diverse a workforce as possible and not truly include everybody.
So one of the real questions is, can you have inclusion when the group doesn't have critical mass in the room? I don't know the answer to that, but I'm very struck with the students at Parkland and with the Me Too movement, that what we have are people speaking up from groups that don't usually speak up, and part of why they're
speaking up... Parkland, the school shooting in Florida.
And it seems as though part of why they're speaking up is that their voices are included in a very positive way in the room, that there's safety. There's so many people that there's safety in speaking out. And that would be the same thing in a business case, it seems to me, that if you felt comfortable in the room, that you were going to get support for who you were. Your idea might be disagreed with, but you were going to get support for who you were and weren't going to be penalized. That then you're going to feel like you can speak up. And pretty much in the business world, the rule of thumb has been that you need to have three people that are like in some kind of way in the room for people to feel safety. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. But I was very struck because there have been some fascinating stories in recent weeks of people who have done things and spoken up in ways which 2 years ago they wouldn't have done. And it really is about feeling included, feeling as though what your opinion is being valued.
And at the same time, I talk to people in upper management all the time, and they're like, these millennials drive them nuts because they come into Emory, they get a job, and then they like email Bill Gates and say, Bill, I got some ideas about this Microsoft.
Yeah, right.
Right, and so there's
But the challenge is
it's a
upper
real
management.
Challenge. No,
right,
that's right.
That they
right.
have something to say, and frequently more articulately than upper management.
That's right.
Not always, though.
Not always.
See, and that's the difficulty.
No,
I'm trying to think, this is all about where the rubber meets the road, right? That's what this panel is about.
Right.
And I'm trying to think that I have had young people come in who have wondered why they weren't included on every decision. And that's just not possible, right? And this is what makes it so difficult.
Right. Yeah.
It's like I can't include every single employee on every single decision that we make. It would take us too long to make every decision.
Right. But I think it's different from being included in every decision to feeling valued.
That's the key. Feeling like you belong. I mean, the key for belonging isn't necessarily always being at the table and saying, "Hey, I want your opinion," or you want to put your opinion there. Belonging is deeper, right? It's cultural deep is what I call it. Where it's about how you feel when you're getting up in the morning and knowing that you're going to walk into that building and people are going to respect and value you for bringing your whole self to work.
Right.
Right, it's the hardest thing that I think we can do, but I think it's where the rubber meets the road. If we can crack the inclusion piece, that's where I think we can make some incremental breakthrough. I think you can never forget about the D, the diversity, the representation. But even if you have, to your point, if you can have as much diversity in the room as you want, what you actually do if you do have an exclusive culture, you're bringing people literal pain. We've been talking to some neuroscientists who've been helping us understand how the brain works when it's excluded. And there's some interesting data to show that. It's not even interesting. It's factual data that says if someone is excluded, no matter whether you're diverse or not, you will literally feel the same. The neurons that fire off that happen when you have a physical pain is the same neurons that fire off when you're excluded. So to me, that's the burning platform for me when I think about it. And what keeps me honest is because if we don't have an inclusive culture, to me, you're actually literally bringing someone pain. So let's focus on that if you can. It's hard. The hardest thing to do, though. So I'm not saying it's something we have
but
to
let me, one thing on top of that, and I think the evidence, right, is really strong. And I think I can't remember if Catherine, who was a chair I talked about in this book, because we're debating about who includes it. But there's one book by William Swan at Texas and Jeff Polzer at Harvard saying, being validated really matters. But the other thing that is so important in this space is that when we say inclusion, that means, I think, it has to mean two things. And Kim Cook has a wonderful new book on this. It has to mean that you care about people personally in a way, that they feel like you want them to succeed, that you're going to mentor them, that you care about their career. But you also have to challenge them directly. And it also means that you feel safe enough to put forward ideas that can get challenged.
You're listening to a panel discussion on diversity in the workplace. It was recorded last week at the Carter Center in Atlanta. On Second Thought, host Celeste Headlee moderated it with four guests. You just heard from University of Michigan diversity expert Scott Page. We also heard from former CNN Executive Vice President Gail Evans, Andrew Davis of the Coca-Cola Company, and Emory University's Janine Cabrera-Veldy. Celeste Headlee asked Janine how to maintain diversity on college campuses with first-generation students when many of them drop out because they don't feel included.
I mean, I think it also means that you have to go back to the drawing board to understand what are our mission, vision, and values for what we stand for in the university context, in an organization, because I think that's the root of where culture comes from. Like, a culture of inclusivity comes in the way of, do you value this enough to include it in what your organization stands for? So I think it's going back to the drawing board, also figuring out what is it that we value, what is our vision 10 years, 15 years down the road, and what's our true mission in this area of inclusivity. Because if that language is not included at the very core of universities or of organizations, then I really don't think that you can fully move forward honestly saying that you care about things like the D&I space. So I think that
D&I stands for
diversity and inclusion. So I think it means kind of starting once again at that root and really figuring out, well, what is our culture really about, so that we can begin to have people really understand, whether it's like students, have students understand what we really stand for. Because when you have that kind of language included, I think that that already starts to change things and changes what the goals are.
It's difficult, though. Oh, go ahead.
Let me just quickly say, Scott, you talked about, well, back up and just say, the answer for that lies within the people.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
If you ask students what's important, what makes them feel including and that they belong, you'll more than likely get it. Now, what you'll also get is probably 50 different ideas, right?
Right.
I get
right.
that, right? So you have to understand how you can actually take these ideas and turn them into action. And each university is going to have its own nuance in terms of what culturally feeling like belonging does, right? I mean, a simple thing that I'm very proud to say when we were talking to associates saying, what makes you feel like you're part of this company? Again, we haven't cracked the code on it, but it's simple things that you can maybe try to symbolize. Like, for instance, we have all the 207 flags that we operate in hung on a rafter as you walk into the building. And I'm from Jamaica, and so I'm a little country of 3 million people. And you're walking in, and I'm like, that's my green, black, yellow flag right there. There is something symbolic that makes me feel like, wow. And as a matter of fact, 10 years ago when I was thinking about coming to Coke, that was the magic that had me say yes. Because I'm like, wow, my little country where I grew up is actually here represented on these flags. It's little things like that that can go a long way. The bigger things are, you know, how do you make sure that it's in your values, it's part of your business plan. It's part of leadership behaviors that you expect from people. But don't sleep on the small stuff. They can make a big difference.
Okay, so let's get to some of these questions. This is from a faculty member at Georgia State University who says, considering the internet age, could you make a comment on millennials' perception of diversity? Janine, you want to answer that?
It's the only millennial.
We're not that old.
So it's what's millennials' perception of diversity?
Yes.
Oh, man. I mean, I just feel like millennials in general are probably the group that are growing up in this day and age that are more open to diversity than any other group. I feel like they're the ones that are currently out protesting on things that on social justice issues. So I feel like more than anything, I think millennials truly value it. I think they're in a day and age where they're really engaged in all of the issues that are currently out, whether it's political issues, whether it's gun violence, whatever it is. I feel like millennials truly value it. And I think that we are lucky to grow up in a space where we've seen more and more acceptance. And so we're able to have more discourse on those types of topics than I think maybe other generations may not have been able to have.
Okay. Let me just add one quick thing. We have to be very careful because change tends to happen from the top. And one
Correct.
Of the things that I worry about with millennials is that once they get in the system, is the system going to be more powerful or are the millennials going to be
right.
more powerful? And so that we have to keep encouraging that spirit because we've been through other generations where, you know, where people spoke up and then once they became part of the system, fell into.
We see this in the Valley, right? Like we had these millennials start companies and they thought, okay, we need a corporate culture mission. So they just sat down and like wrote it down themselves, you know, without sweating the details the right way, and they've created an industry that's very, you know, male dominated.
Right. It's shocking that when they have the chance, we have the part of the country with the worst diversity problems.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, let me put this one to you, Andrew. Annette Vandeveer says, "What can we do?" I assume she means as consumers, mm-hmm. to assist companies to achieve diversity.
Look, I think you're doing it. I think you're voting with your pocketbooks and your discretionary income every day. I think, you know, organizations like us in the CPG industry understand that consumers have choices. And so what you're looking at is not just the portfolio of what we can offer you to help you, you know, refresh yourselves every day. You're looking at what we stand for. So by the nature of how you shop with your money, you're forcing organizations like us to change or do things differently to be more inclusive. I mean, one of our mission in diversity and inclusion globally is to be as inclusive and diverse as our brands. We know that if we can, you know, we have 500 brands across the world, 3,600 different beverages. Hopefully you've had plenty of those over the last couple of weeks. But we know that if you can actually, we can actually be as diverse as that, from a standpoint of how we think, act, and even represent ourselves, that's a great way to do it. But I think you're forcing it, and consumers aren't shy to telling us what we should do differently. So we listen, we try to act in those things and work it. So your pocketbooks are telling us where we need to go.
Yeah, we all remember New Coke.
I wasn't there.
Gail, this one is for you.
From
Tiffany, a care coordinator, who says, Gail mentioned shifting power. How does that translate into practice throughout the workforce?
Well, I think what happens is that when we talk about identity diversity, the groups that want more power, that want more representation, that want to be authentic, have got to make the moves to take power. I think one of the problems has been that the assumption was, when you believe this is the right thing to do, then clearly the power structure wants to do the right thing, and somehow or other they're going to give away power. And I think that's been one of the big misses for all of us, is that if groups in the identity sphere, but also I would say in the specifically cognitive sphere, want more power, they have to be prepared to stand up and say, I'm willing to put, you know, myself out there in a way that might be uncomfortable. And I think that has not happened with every group yet. I think hopefully we're beginning to make progress, but it's been very slow slogging to get real change.
Gail Evans is a former executive president, vice president at CNN, teaches at Georgia Tech. Andrew Davis, next to her, is global chief diversity and inclusion officer of Coca-Cola. Janine Carpera-Veldi is at Emory, and Scott Page of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much to all of you.
That conversation about workplace diversity was recorded last week at the Carter Center in Atlanta. It was part of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation's Our Compelling Interests series. We'd like to turn the conversation over to you now. If you're a boss, how do you try to address diversity at work? Call us at 404-594-57. That's 404-500-9457. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is @OSTTalk, or post to our Facebook page. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusa. Have a good one.